Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Did you ever lose sight of your plan A in life and settle for plan B? Well, not only does it happen in real life, but it happens in film as well. My guest today is writer-director Jonathan L. Bowen, whose film The Comic Shop follows Mike, the owner of a comic shop, as he grapples with plan B. Shot on location in Las Vegas, The Comic Shop is a slice of life love letter to comic fans and is set for streaming as well. For everything about Jonathan and the film, go to directorbowen.com, directorbowen.com. You can follow him on Instagram and X. And Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. You're a relatively recent resident of Las Vegas, which is probably why you shot it in Las Vegas. But of course, people are interested in the subject matter. I was particularly because I think you're right. I think people have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C. And I think some people even go for the plan C rather than a plan A or plan B. But tell us a little bit about your background first. We'll talk about the film, which is set for streaming very shortly. But tell us a little bit about your background, how you ended up in film, and why the subject matter, and why the setting, the comic shop.
Yeah, so I've been interested in being a filmmaker since I was a teen. Pretty much around 13 or 14 is when I realized that, you know, this is something I was really passionate about. And of course, it just starts with making some, you know, cruddy little short films in high school. And, you know, then in college, I messed around with some of my friends making content. I tried to go to film school briefly, but I ended up moving back closer to home and majoring in philosophy, which I actually was very useful to me because I really wanted to make movies or content that, you know, had some sort of value to them, some intellectual value, something more behind it. I does not mean I don't enjoy watching like brainless action films or for what I'm going to spend my own time on. Like, I really wanted it to be something that was a little more thought-provoking. So I had made a feature film in my 20s. I think I was 27 when I directed my first movie. And then more than a decade had passed, and I was doing corporate video work, just trying to honestly stay afloat and trying to get to the next sort of opportunity. But I think wondering if that opportunity would ever come. And so The Comic Shop is almost kind of written from that perspective where you've got a guy who was an illustrator for a little bit. He kind of tasted some level of success, but he could never make a living doing it. So then he starts running a comic shop, which, you know, I think I want to go from the perspective that when I was a kid, that sounded like the coolest thing. I remember talking to comic shops and thinking, oh, this is the life. I mean, he gets to just be here all the time. And he's like surrounded by all this great stuff. But as a kid, you don't realize the reality of like bookkeeping, accounting, employees, and insurance, and orders every week, and all of this. And I think it's really started to weigh on Mike, our main character. And so he's, instead of like maybe thinking about trying plan A again, he's just stuck in a rut. So he goes across the street, you know, has some beers with lunch, kind of isn't really present in his company. And I think the pandemic affected him with that as well, because he had, you know, this period of time where no one was even coming in, and now business is even worse. So maybe he had the self-esteem before the pandemic of saying, well, okay, I'm not following my plan A, but business is pretty good. I make a good living. And then by the time we find him in the movie, he's actually living at the back of the store with like curtains, you know, covering up his living space. So I wanted to almost hint that he hasn't been doing that for 15 years. Like, this is a recent development where he lost his apartment and now has to make it work as both a place to live and a place to do business.
I watched the trailer of the film, and there's this one little snippet, and a gentleman comes into the store, and without looking at any of the credits ahead of time, I just wanted to see the trailer. I said, boy, he looks familiar. And then, of course, my curiosity got the best of me when my brain didn't work and I couldn't figure out who it was. And then realized it was Eric Roberts.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's an interesting, and you have some local Las Vegas favorites, performers. Carrot Top is one, and Murray the Magician, who's been a guest on my show.
Oh, neat.
Times over the
I
years.
love Murray.
So yeah, so that's great that you incorporated some of that as well. But the story is not really about Las Vegas so much as it is more, as you said earlier, well, you didn't say it this way, but I'll say it for you, philosophical, because
Yes.
the philosophy that you took in college helped you, I think,
Right.
in terms of writing this as well.
Yeah, I did want to incorporate a little. One thing I had that I was thinking of is this real small book called The Death of Ivan Illich. I mean, I'm probably saying that slightly wrong, but so basically, we read this. It was the first philosophy class I ever took. And it seems very depressing. It's a guy like on his deathbed, just looking through his life and all the regrets he had and all the things he didn't do. And so our professor said, I know what you guys are all thinking. This is the most depressing book you've ever read. That's this small. But he said, but it isn't, though. It isn't for you because you don't have to be Ivan Illich. You're all in college. And he said, so use this as a cautionary tale. You have your entire life to make sure that this isn't you when you're 80 years old or, whatever it is. And I thought that was a really good way to look at that, like just to make sure that we all get caught up in our daily lives and the things that have to be done. But time is passing quicker than it seems sometimes. And you at least want to say that you gave it a go. Like, even if maybe you didn't succeed to your wildest expectations, that you tried and you put out everything you could. And at least then you don't have regret. You're like, well, it didn't work out, but I don't have to sit here and wonder what if I had just been a little bit, more courageous. So I think for the movie, it's certainly like, I don't want to overstate it as it's saying, quit your day job, go be a rock and roll musician like you want to do when you were 15. That's not realistic for everybody,
Right.
but it might be something like, take some time on the weekends or, nights when you have time to pursue your passion and just see where it might take you. At least you're going to get that fulfillment out of it.
Now, what happens if you have, though, there are these people in life, of course, and I'm sure you've bumped into them, that their plan A really is not to do much. In other words, they want to, plan A is to avoid work, avoid stress, and just eat and drink and have a place to stay. So,
I know a few of those.
right.
Yeah, I
So
do know a few of those.
that's not the theme of your movie, but that might be your next movie about those people that are satisfied with a plan A, but it's not the real plan A of somebody wanting to achieve something. So, but that's good. So I like the fact that you have that spirit because you have a full-time company, a production company. You could talk a little bit about it, but you took the time to fulfill what you wanted to do. And it's not easy. People think it's easy. It's not easy making a film. Even an independent film, even a low budget film or a low budget independent film, it doesn't matter because you have there's a lot of elements to this. Even if you've got people volunteering and both on crew and on cast, it doesn't matter. You're scheduling, there's shooting, you have to get it right as best you can. It's not an easy process.
Yeah, and when you're talking about like small films like this, it in a lot of ways it's much more difficult for the director than like a big budget film because I have to do a lot more jobs. Like I don't have an assistant to help. And sometimes, even though it's like technically somebody else's job, if I don't make sure it gets done, I can't be sure that it will happen at all.
Yeah, you're
So,
the director, the assistant director, the assistant to the assistant director, the gopher, the
yeah.
capper,
And so a lot of people say, my wife tells me this all the time. She'll be like, well, just remember, Jonathan, like no one cares more than you do. And I'm like, yeah, that's an important thing to
Yeah,
remember. So
right,
somebody else
exactly.
may get the job done, but not the way that I want it done. And I can't necessarily fault them because, yeah, we don't have the most pay. So, maybe one good example is I feel like about 8 weeks before we shot, I put it on the radar as something really important. We need to reach out to a bunch of these indie comics companies and get clearance. I want to, have a bunch of other comics we can use as production design. Or even as props that
Right.
somebody's thumbing through. And I kind of felt like I heard each week it was like, oh yeah, no, it'll get done. Like, oh yeah, for sure. Like, we'll take care of that. And then it kind of got closer and closer to where I was like, I don't see anybody taking care of this. I see this being some sort of like half-assed last minute thing, And so I just started reaching out to all the companies myself and saying, hey, I'm writer director of this movie called The Comic Shop. It really doesn't focus on Marvel and DC comics as much. We really want to have like indie comics, just like we're an indie movie, to
Right.
be true. And you know, the companies were very responsive overall. And I did get, I can't remember the one, but one of the companies was so funny because he was just, I totally understand this running a company with two employees plus me. So he sends me back and he said, yeah, no problem. You know, I'll send you these comics. But he said, I just have to let you know it might take me a few days because I'm not only the editor in chief, but I'm editor. And he said, I'm also the coffee maker. And you know, he had like every.
He's another Jonathan.
Yeah. And
Yeah,
so I
right.
said, no worries. I totally understand that because I have people tell me like, oh, just have your bookkeepers deal with this, or oh, you know, send it to your HR department. And I'm like, buddy, you're looking at the HR department, the bookkeeping, all of those things at once.
It's a good thing he didn't have you do the legal department because you're not qualified to be a lawyer yet, but.
No, I so it's funny because I read that well, I heard this a couple times when I was going to school. That philosophy majors usually do better on the LSAT than pre-law, because we do like we deal with a lot of law issues in philosophy, and I even took a class, philosophy of the law, and it was kind of talking about more like more esoteric things that just because it's the law doesn't make it right. It's a matter of like what society's agreed upon or what has went through the process to become law,
Yeah,
and
that's
so you know definitely like. I try to be as legally aware as I can. Just, I feel like as somebody who owns a company, you have to at least delve into that somewhat because you can get into some trouble, right? If I'm like, for instance, for us, we classify all of our videographers as contractors. We don't pay them as employees.
right,
But
independent contractors.
as a result, I have to make sure that I'm complying with those rules. So that includes things like not telling them how to do their job. I hire them as professionals. I trust them to do the job they were hired to do, the same as an electrician or a plumber. But the second you start micromanaging, that becomes an employee, not a contractor. And a lot of people think, no, because I'm going to pay them for 3 days. I'm like, it doesn't matter how many days you pay them for, it matters the way that their employment is engaged.
Including, I think, if I'm correct, that there's a time element too to it. For example, if you assign them, you have to be here at this time. That may also kind of weave into that.
So we'll set times, but they allow it because it's based on like let's say an event schedule. Like you can't control it that CES is going on from I don't know 8 in the morning till you know 6 at night, but you also have to be flexible with them. So instead of telling them a date, like oh it, you know if it's an event maybe okay, but a lot of the time it's not like this is January 15th. It's like, hey, so the client threw out these dates, like January 15, 16, 20, 25, or 28. Like, which one works for you? And then at least they're choosing the date because
Yeah,
any
that's
dates
true.
can work, you
Yeah,
know?
no, that's good. I wanted to ask you, let's go back to the beginning because I
Yes.
never forget something that intrigues me and I have to go back. When you were doing films as a kid,
Oh.
what was the technology at that point? Were you shooting video? Were you shooting film as an 8 millimeter or 16 millimeter or?
So we shot, I got my first like really bad camera. It was I can't remember the brand, but it's one of those mini DV recorders. So
Yeah.
they're real small.
Right.
And eventually, I think I want to say it was my senior year in high school, I asked for the Canon XL1S, which was at least a more professional mini DV. But I mean, still, you're talking about filming in standard definition. It isn't like these things look that good, but I think it was what a 28 Days Later, I think the zombie film, they shot on the Canon XL1, and so professionals could make it work provided they were going with the right aesthetic look.
Right.
My best friend and I at that time, we had a good laugh about like we were by this point in time we were in LA, and I think we were like cruising on Sunset or something, and we were talking about new Blu-rays because Blu-ray was kind of pretty new at that time. And he said, did you see that they're releasing a Blu-ray of 28 Days Later? And I said, no, I didn't hear about that, but Wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense, though, because if the movie was shot in standard definition, it can't have a Blu-ray. Like, all you'd be doing is upscaling the standard def.
Yeah, it's still
It
standard.
doesn't make any sense, because the whole point of like movies that went to Blu-ray is you can scan a movie at 4K. You could scan a movie at 8K if you wanted. So to put it into HD, it's going to look better. But if it was acquired in a standard definition format, it can't really just magically be ballooned up. Now, I say that nowadays, maybe it could be with AI, but AI wasn't a thing like 18 years ago or whatever, 16.
The reason I asked that question too is that you're a relatively young guy. I'm wondering if you ever got exposed to what used to be the hallmark of filming, which is film as opposed celluloid as opposed to digital or videotape. Did you ever work with film at all?
No, so I'll be honest, I'm one of those, most of the people I know at this point in the industry are they're very enamored by film. It's almost like records.
Yeah.
I was always like, I don't want to deal with that. I was very like, I'm enjoying the tech that's coming out. I like all the cutting edge stuff. So I was in film school at LA Film School, and we had this cinematography teacher, Blaine Brown, really great. I mean, he really knew his lighting, really knowledgeable guy. He has a couple great books out, but he was not adapting with the times. So my business partner and I, right after film school, we had a Red One on order, a Red Digital Cinema. And he insisted to us that, oh, it's vaporware. It's never going to exist. They can't do it. It can't compete with film. And so I was like, well, we actually have the cameras on order right now. We've made deposits on them. And he's like, well, yeah, they're never going to come out. So he had up front one day, a film camera, so that we could see how it's loaded, how the whole process works. Everybody got around this camera, and I'm in the back row, I can hardly see it. There wasn't time for each of us to go mess with it. So I just went back and sat down, and I told my business partners, we'll never have to need to know how that works. That's yesterday's technology. I'm sorry. So it was one of those things where I was happy to come around when I did, because not only that, as an indie filmmaker, film is expensive.
Yes,
I
it
mean,
is.
it looks fantastic, and you can go with a lot of different looks with it. But I had my best friend at the time. He was in film school, and I won't mention the company because, that's his private stuff. But a certain company was processing his film, his short film, and they basically spilled chemicals all over it. And so they wrote him a letter that I remember holding in the car, because I went on this errand with them. And it basically said, though we acknowledge no wrongdoing whatsoever, this check enclosed is for your inconvenience during the process. And big companies don't pay out checks if they didn't think they did something wrong. They knew they did something wrong, but they don't want to actually admit any sort of wrongdoing. So it's kind of like this little wink, wink, here's your check, don't sue us.
I got you. Well, the reason I'm asking that question too, because with today's technology, especially, you can add a cinematic effect to shooting digitally anyway, so it looks like it was shot on film. So you don't have to do that, but it's still an interesting process if you've ever been exposed to film cameras and moviolas and all that kind of stuff. It's
Oh,
really,
I know.
yeah,
Yeah, it is.
and it makes you appreciate the old filmmakers because of what they were working with to be able to create that artistry. I don't know how they did it, but it's great.
Yeah, and when you look at the old moviolas and just thinking about them cutting apart, just frame by frame and splicing it together, I love those old, making of features, and
Right.
it
And
is quick.
you end up with Citizen Kane somehow. So there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. We were very fortunate on this movie. I couldn't believe it. So the Alexa 35 had just come out in the summer. It was like June 2022. And that was kind of a camera I thought, I would like to film on that. The old Alexa was an amazing camera, but it wasn't a 4K camera. So they would usually actually upscale in post. And that kind of bothered me in a sense, because I have a Red Scarlett in my garage. That thing's been 4K for 10 years. But Alexa dominated the market because the color science was so good. It just looks, it's such a nice image. So the Alexa 35 comes out, and I think it's 4.6K with even more stops at dynamic range. This thing absolutely blew me away because, I mean, this makes me sound like I haven't done anything for a while, but when I was in film school, I asked the question, so if I'm shooting inside and I've got a big bank of windows and it's daylight, like how do I make that look good? Because it just looks totally blown out. And they all said, don't shoot into a big bank of windows. That was basically the answer. And they said, unless I can get enough light inside to match the color temperature and match the energy of the sun. And I was like, okay, that would require a crew vastly bigger than anything I've worked with. So I just learned, shoot around that. Don't ever shoot into windows like that. So then we were doing.
But the importance, you mentioned a very good point there. It's not just the camera, but the lighting that's a key
That's
aspect
right.
of filmmaking.
The lighting is huge, but like the way as these cameras have developed, they're so much more lenient on your lighting demands. Like, of course, you have to make sure it looks good, but there's things they can do where in the past the only solution would have been like better lighting. So for this thing, we had shots like where it's inside the comic shop, and then you see the big bank of windows. And on set, I'm looking at the monitor, and they looks blown out to me. You can't really see anything. And I'm like, well, that's the way that it is because there's, a quarter of the room is windows. So then we get into post, and through color correction, we can bring it all back. So now you can see every single detail from the parking lot. It's not blown out at all. And I mean, but what was blown out is my mind because I couldn't believe that I'm looking at these scenes and all the detail that was there is still there. It's not blown out at
And
all.
with color correction, that's also through digital tools, right? In terms of color
Right.
correction,
So I think I don't know for sure what they would have used, but I would assume they would use DaVinci Resolve. Like, I mean, DaVinci like had some of the best color correction
We don't want
software.
to get too much in the weeds for our audience, but I understand. I'm only slightly nerdy. You're full nerdy, so it's fine.
Trust me, I don't. I when it comes to some of the tech stuff, I know a little about a lot, but like not a lot about any one element.
I want to talk to you about the casting for the comic shop, how you went about doing that, and the fact that, and also the time frame that you took to film it, or tape it, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And then what the future is you see for the film as well. And again, too, for people that are interested in when it'll be streamed, go to Director Bowen, Bowen, directorbowen.com. But tell us a little bit about how the casting went, and if you want to mention some of the cast members, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. So, with our lead role, Jesse Metcalf, we had kind of went through a list of people where it's like, these are who the distributor said moves the needle. So a big part of it is like, we needed to cast somebody who a distributor says, yes, if you have this person in your movie, that increases the chance we can get this budget back. And so Jesse, I think,
Wait one
was.
second, Jonathan. When they say that to you, do they put that in writing or are they just telling you that? Because you can go and cast for their recommendation, they still might not take you up as a distributor.
That's right. Yeah. So because for us, it wasn't an actual minimum guarantee. It was more of like a helpful hint.
Gotcha.
So as they kind of told us these people, some of them might surprise you where you're kind of like, I'm surprised they care about that person. But then the other ones, make some level of sense. And so we went through this process for quite a while. I don't want to like mention every actor we offered first. And by the way, it is no reflection. Like, let's say Jesse Metcalf was not the first choice. That it doesn't mean that. All it means is that he wasn't even brought to our attention at that time.
No, understood totally. We have a few minutes left, so go ahead and mention some of your cast members. I think people would be
Yeah,
interested.
so another one, our lead actress is Kristen Mayes, and I had seen her on the reboot of MacGyver. So I thought she would be perfect for the role. And she accepted within about 48 hours, which is really exciting. We're very happy to have her. And Micah Giovanni is a total unknown, but he acts opposite Jesse. So it was really important that, he could match that, like that he could bring his energy and sort of give Mike a tough time. Like his job's to kind of bring out a better version of Mike. So we had seen a lot of different faces. And that was the first part, because I said, I don't want to cast a 27-year-old to play a 16-year-old. I get tired of that as a film watcher. So Micah was very petite. He's 20 years old. And we saw this great reel. And I thought, I think this is our guy. And so we got him on a Zoom call with Jesse, and they had great rapport, and we went on our way. And I think he really delivered for us. Then there was other little things, like Trevor Einhorn is our antagonist. He was on like Mad Men for about 13 episodes. So he has a big arc on that show. But people have seen him in maybe things like The Magicians. He actually was just on Curb Your Enthusiasm, like one of the last episodes ever of the show. And he's yelling at Larry about something. I can't remember what.
Everybody yells at Larry.
Everybody yells at Larry. So that was fun. And then the little cameos you mentioned, I think those were some of those, especially Carrot Top and Murray, were kind of important to me because I wanted to make this at least somewhat of a Vegas movie, but not in the way of like the strip and tourism. Mm-hmm. I want it to be like Vegas is also a fairly normal city where people live fairly normal lives most of the time.
Exactly.
Most of us locals, most of us locals don't go to the strip that much. It's more when like friends and family visit,
of course.
Maybe it's a special occasion and you want to go see a comedy show or a variety show or something like that. So it was great having Carrot Top there.
Absolutely. Before I let you go, give us a sense of what you want people to learn from the movie or to get from the movie. Maybe that's a better term. And we'll talk about what you envision as the future for the movie as well. So go ahead. What do you want people to get from the movie?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing I want people to get is, you know, it's never too late to pursue your passions. Just because you've been doing something and all your expertise is in another area, it doesn't mean you have to give up completely on something else that you really love. A lot of people have had second acts in life or second careers. And maybe even if it's something like painting and you want to do it when you retire, well, could you start a little bit now? Could you do something on weekends? And it doesn't have to be for money. It could just be something that you always wanted to do, because tomorrow isn't guaranteed either. And the other big thing is sort of the interconnectedness of relationships. So I think the movie focuses a lot on how Mike and Brandon's relationship changes each other, but it also changes the way that they interact with other people. So Brandon forms a close relationship with his dad. Mike realizes he's been kind of a jerk to his main employee who he actually really cares about. So I think there's that element of like all of our relationships are interconnected in some way. And the way that we behave with each other has ripple effects is sort of how I look at that.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been writer-director Jonathan L. Bowen, whose film The Comic Shop is set for streaming. For everything about Jonathan and the film, go to Director Bowen, B-O-W-E-N, directorbowen.com. And you can follow him on Instagram and X. And Jonathan, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.